Reservable. It's the Reservable. It's the Reservable. It's the Reservable. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Joe Yule. And today we are getting back into some TEDx content for you. It is that time of year where we're warming up for what is coming in March. And we're very excited because things have changed quite dramatically since our last installment. We have a new title. We are now TEDx Ibiza, which is a massive catapult forwards. And we are now a national event. Effectively, which feels pretty exciting for all those involved. And joining us today, we have the lead curator, Adam Norris, who is going to be telling us all about the selection process for the speakers and all the hard work that goes in by the entire team to select our incredible selection of talent that always takes a massive selection process every single year. Now, we're just about to get into that conversation for you. Joining us is Adam Norris.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thank you for popping in on this beautiful, wet, windy January evening. It's an absolute pleasure to have you with us. I mean, just tell us a little bit about the selection process. I understand this is just such a lot of work that goes into curating this program.
It starts very early on, first of all, with the theme. Thinking culture is such an enormous theme to think about. And every year we're trying to curate with a bit more intention. In previous years, it's been like a very open theme that you could almost chuck anything into. This year, you know, thinking culture is a big theme, but we narrowed it down and spent a lot of time thinking about how can we create a focus for this. And then once we arrive at that point, we start to think, right, who are the right speakers? What's the mix? What's the balance that we want to achieve? People from the island, Spanish speakers, male, female. And then we start to go after people, invitations, ask around, have conversations with people. And a number of names get thrown into the hat. We consider them, think about what ideas they have. And from that, a short list starts to develop. Every year some people sign up and then can't make the commitment. So it kind of whittles itself down. And then we begin work, you know, really by September, you know, asking for first drafts, and the talks develop hugely in that process from the first draft to the final draft. So really from September till now, we're arriving at a final draft and getting that locked in and getting people to the stage where they can just start memorizing, thinking about their performance, no longer scripting and changing ideas, just thinking all about delivery.
Sounds like there's quite a lot of rallying the troops that sort of needs to happen to get those talks delivered on time.
Yes, there is a bit of herding cats that goes into the process. You know, people are really busy. I think a lot of people don't really understand the commitment that's involved. I think a lot of people are asked to, you know, or they may already talk in public. But I think with TEDx, it's quite a big stage. It's a very personal, you know, calling card that they're creating. And we also ask people to memorize it. You know, there's no cue cards. There's no auto cue. People have to memorize the entire talk. And to be able to do that, you really have to get down to a draft that you're completely happy with and then start to mechanically memorize it. And then you can relax on stage and start thinking about delivery and how you want to come across. So it is a big ask. It's a big commitment from people. But I think everybody's grateful for it, you know, by the time the event happens, because they're well prepared, they're well drilled, they know what they're doing, and they feel really confident.
I mean, do you think everyone's got a TEDx talk in them?
No, definitely not. I think, you know, we've found that a lot of people look like they'll be fantastic speakers, but they're really not sure what they want to talk about. And that indecision, you know, can be a nightmare for everyone because, you know, one week the talk's about this and the next week it's about something completely different. I think part of the selection process is not just to choose, you know, great, talented people. You really have to identify people who've got a talk in them, something they're already quite driven, motivated by, and want to get across to a wider audience?
I mean, obviously, I was just hosting a salon a couple of weeks back at Soho House on the culture of music. And I think you've got, you know, starting off in the first quarter, a very interesting speaker from Earth Percent, Sophia Snap.
Yeah, she's fantastic. I think that'll be a great talk. And it's, you know, huge in scope. And, you know, she's extremely passionate about it and you know, has invested a lot of time into it. And I think the audience will really like that talk.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe someone that you're kind of particularly looking forward to hearing from, seeing as you selected all nine speakers?
Well, I think, you know, we've kind of curated it into, you know, there'll be three sessions. Each session will have three speakers. And I think it's, you know, there's a build up to the day. So the morning we've kind of loosely termed to be about island culture and music. The middle session is about the artists. And then the afternoon is about culture, and in particular popular culture and what we understand is, you know, happening there. And the three speakers in the afternoon are really breaking down. You know, I think we don't realize how much popular culture is changing as a result of technology platforms and algorithmically driven content. And all these three speakers have a fantastic take on what's happening to us, as you know, in terms of our own wiring, internal wiring, but also what's happening to us as a society as a result of that culture. And I think it's hugely important for all of us to be aware of that.
I'm particularly looking forward to Benji Rogers, the active daily user to daily active citizen. And he's obviously like a recovering alcoholic and technologist. And I'm going to be speaking to him in the coming weeks. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more, perhaps tease us about what's the contents of that talk? It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, Benji is a fantastic speaker, and he's got a unique insight into this subject. And, you know, yes, he's a recovering alcoholic. He's really looked at the steps and processes of getting away from that addiction. And what's fascinating about his talk is how the way we are using technology, and not by choice, but the way the technology platforms are designed, they are designed to, you know, in very similar ways to get us addicted. And that's, you know, that can be seen as a controversial statement, but I think Benji breaks it down for us fantastically and looks at the way we need to, first of all, identify the problem and then start taking steps that are within our powers to regain some control over that. And it's not just about the personal ramifications of that behavior. It has huge ramifications for us as a society and for our culture in particular. And I really, you know, I think it's a fantastic talk for everyone to listen to, you know, whether they can come on the day or whether they see it later on.
Why do you think that, you know, technology is impacting popular culture so dramatically? I mean, what do you sort of see as the evolution? What do you see as the evolution of this?
Well, I think, you know, it's the attention economy. Is these platforms are designed to turn us all into daily active users. They're designed to up the amount of time we spend on them. They're designed to, you know, really control our eyeballs, control our attention, and through that, you know, monetize that attention. And I think they're, you know, they're driven by performance metrics, by profit, and there's no real consideration of the cultural impact of that, the knock-on effects to us as a society. And they've found, you know, through a lot of trial and error, but a lot of kind of insight and understanding, that attention is most often peaked when there is controversy, when there is division, when there is argument. And in many, many ways, they are geared up towards us shouting at each other. And in that way, they keep us on the line. They keep us hooked.
I mean, obviously, you've got kids and that must, you know, kind of affect them and that must kind of, you know, infiltrate your thought process and that to a degree. I mean, how do you feel their perception and the intrusion of that is actually directly affecting, you know, the future generations?
Yeah, I think it's affected hugely. I think, you know, my kids, you know, late teens now, and I think we were that generation that really didn't understand what this technology was. You know, I remember thinking, oh, you know, you can watch a movie on your phone, you know, how great, and you can go out to dinner and give the phone to your kid and you can have a fantastic dinner together. And it was all, you know, kind of so innocent in a way, the way we let our kids have this technology. Whereas I think now people are becoming increasingly aware that it's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea to give your kids phones too early, and you really have to take care of that interaction with social media. And I think there's a kind of consensus brewing around keeping kids away from social media, you know, up to a certain age. It hasn't happened yet, but I think it's, you know, it's happened in Australia, and I think it will happen elsewhere. I'm not sure if an outright ban is the right way to go. I think when you ban things, you know, in many ways kind of creates a greater incentive for people to get onto it. But I think parents now are much, much, much more aware of it. And I think there will be kind of greater control and people using it. But I think for this generation, it's sort of, you know, unmitigated access to screens and content, you know, constant stimulation. And I think there will be consequences for that.
I mean, obviously, with the final talk with Isabel Bruce talking about the algorithm not being able to save democracy, I mean, you know, you're going to be leaving people, I guess, with a little bit of thought-provoking subject matter to take away with them, and then, you know, have a think about what that kind of means moving forward. How would you like to see that mitigated?
Yeah, I think in relation to children, you know, ultimately I would like to see tech platforms take responsibility for the content that's on there. And there's a court case happening in the States right now where Facebook are in court exactly on that issue. And I think that's where responsibility lies. It relies with the tech platforms. They need regulation. I think in the meantime, parents are going to have to exert some control over their kids, because the kids really can't regulate themselves. You know, I was always hoping that I'd be able to teach my kids to regulate and use it kind of responsibly, but it's designed to be addictive. So I think parents have to get involved. They have to really stick their noses in, set some boundaries, set some limits, and you know, allow kids to be bored and separate from this content and these screens.
I read a book called Bored and Brilliant, and you know exactly what you say. I think there's something very magic that does happen when we are not using a telephone to distract ourselves from every single moment of every given day, you know, whether we're waiting at the supermarket queue or for the tube to come or the train or whatever. Obviously it doesn't really happen on Ibiza, but in general, you know, it's just a distracted, you know, distractive tool, and sometimes that can be super helpful, obviously. I think it's very easy sometimes, though, with this future of AI discussion and algorithms, to talk about the negative impact and connotations of that. But I wonder, like, you know, obviously there's a lot of positivity, and you are a creative director who focuses on ideas and copy and production and developing and producing all things content related. So what do you think, you know, what do you think the positive side of that coin of evolution of AI and all these incredible technologies are?
Yeah, I think there's enormous potential in AI. You know, it is, you know, some people describe it as a tool, but I, you know, I read something the other day that said it's actually an infrastructure. It's going to, you know, hollow out the way we do everything and replace it with a new infrastructure. And I think it can and will have huge benefits. However, you know, the investment is all about monetizing AI. You know, even though it has this potential to do good and will do good, I think that desire to monetize it and make profit from it will have these enormous consequences, you know, in the same way we've been talking about now in relation to the attention economy. Instead of this social media, which is kind of largely user-generated content and people sharing stuff, I think we are going to be fed tons and tons of AI slop. You know, it will all be generated by AI, and it will be fed to us, tailored to our specific needs. It will know us much better than even, you know, companies understand us now from the data that we hand over to them. But also in relation to jobs, employment, you know, and what we as a society can afford, the increasing inequality, it will have huge knock-on effects. And that's before you get to the prospect of, you know, general intelligence AI, which is that question of whether it will supersede human intelligence and when that will occur, and will we still be able to have control over it, or will we lose control, which is, you know, another frightening prospect.
In the research process of these talks, you know, and the kind of, you know, the things that you've learned and observed, I guess, from the subject matter that people have been covering, I mean, you know, if you could be a horse and put some blinkers on, what are the things that you would like to, you know, perhaps move to the wayside and into the kind of blur of the edges in the background? And what would you like to laser focus on moving forward?
Well, I think, you know, this year we've chosen culture for a reason as the theme, and that's the laser focus. I really believe that culture can save us. Art and culture is really what we need now, and is the answer to so many problems that we're dealing with, so many changes in society. And I think the key to it is, you know, exposing kids to art and culture and getting that in them at a young age, and remembering how important it is for society. You know, art is what defines us as a species, is what makes us different from all other species, is our propensity to imagine and to create. And culture is how we define ourselves, whether that's as individuals or as groups or as societies. That's who we are. And I think that's what, you know, if there's one thing we'd like to be the takeout of this, is how important art and culture is for us at every single level.
What was your first encounter, you know, art, in terms of art and culture as a child, perhaps your earliest memory that kind of obviously put you on this trajectory career-wise?
Well, I think, you know, everyone's earliest memory, I think, of art is music, and, you know, it's around you all the time growing up. But I think, you know, for me, that put me on this trajectory was the chance to
Antonio, that's your job.
Because let me just think for one second. Okay. Because to me, it's like, what started me on the career, or what was my earliest memory of exposure to
earliest memory?
Earliest memory. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think everyone's, you know, earliest encounter with culture is music, and it's kind of around you all the time. And, you know, I was a kid who was growing up in the golden age of television, and television was like, you know, a national event. Everybody was watching, you know, these moments at the same time. When I was a kid, there were, you know, I think there were only three channels, you know, at that time. And so, you know, it was a cultural conversation around television. I think that's super interesting, is essentially television is a technological platform, but it became an art form. It became culture. And I think that's one interesting question, is, are these technology platforms that we're dealing with now, do they have that same ability to become culture in a meaningful way that, like, television does? Or is it just about getting us hooked in, addicted, and feeding us content, you know, as eyeballs for monetization? For me, I do remember, you know, I think culture in schools, you know, we were singing songs in assembly, you know, every day of the week. And then schools really put a huge emphasis on getting you out and about to museums, to theatres. And I think that's the emphasis that we need right now. It's so important, as we see these increasing seeds of division being sown, that it's actually culture that really counteracts that. An understanding, a perception of culture. And I also think, you know, we're seeing amongst teenage boys in particular increasing misogyny, increasing sympathy towards populism and fascistic views. And I think a lot of that comes from this sort of singular idea of what success looks like, which is financial success. And I think culture is also the antidote to that. You know, I think it's hugely important that, you know, if you've got boys, you get them out and they see culture, they see art, they understand success to be a hugely multifaceted thing. And, you know, it will only benefit everybody if we place that emphasis on art and culture.
It's funny you bring that up. I hadn't been to a museum, I think, well, not for quite some time. And my dad, 89-year-old father, decided that he'd quite like to go to the Imperial War Museum on Boxing, or the day after Boxing Day. And I was a bit, you know, dubious to begin with and thought, you know, that's going to be really cheerful on a cold winter's December day. And actually, you know, we spent about 5 hours in there and it was quite hard to leave. And it was obviously not the most, you know, joyous experience in some ways. But I mean, actually, you know, just going through the entire history and you know, everything that brought us to this point, you know, was just incredibly, obviously humbling. But, you know, remembering not just from a historical perspective, but through art and culture, all those, you know, incredible creatives that come before and shape, you know, everything that we consume and the way that we consume it is, you know, it's very powerful. And it's not to be underestimated, as you said, the impact. I mean, what would you like to see the impact of this conference, you know, what's the kind of subtle imprint that you would like that experience to leave on people after TEDx?
I think two things. I think one, as mentioned, is this focus on culture. I think it's what we need now. I think, you know, politics is in a total mess. I think the media is following politics. And I think we need to double down on culture and art and community and, you know, bringing people together through that and building a kind of almost a consensus below the level of politics and the media, that kind of understanding. I think the harder question is, you know, and this is what Isabel talks about, is this: we are not as divided as we think. You know, I think what's getting amplified is the division, but the opposite of division is actually connection. That's what the conclusion of her talk is. And, you know, the magic of connection so often happens offline. But the real question is, you know, do you give up on online? And I think that is the challenge, is online is so powerful. You know, it's so much is driven by that. People really have to function and exist online. And it's how can we be constructive, how can we do this with culture, how can we be meaningful in our online interaction and our online experience.
I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there in terms of I think witnessing what's been going on in Iran, for example. I mean, the massacre there and the blackout, but prior to all of that, I think culture seemingly was just an act of revolution and rebellion, and it's watching, you know, people willing to put their life on the line to, you know, sing a song and perform it and put it on Instagram, or I don't know, create a piece of art, or, you know, wear a certain piece of clothing or do a certain dance. I mean, that has for me been one of the most moving parts of watching people publishing that kind of content from over there right now, because it's like, you know, they're willing, they feel that it's necessary to put that art and culture, you know, out and celebrate, you know, their nation in the way that they perceive it to be. And obviously we can't witness that. So for me, I feel like that's been a, you know, quite a painful thing to witness, but, you know, a very kind of revolutionary act.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the great hope for social media. You know, I think when you go back to the Arab Spring, you thought, look, here is a platform for people to broadcast to the world and galvanize around their own experience and what's happening to them there and then. And we really thought social media was going to be that kind of liberating platform. But I think what we've seen is social media feels incredibly toxic. It really feels designed to just reel us in and keep our attention there. And, you know, like I mentioned, is the next phase is already coming. AI-driven content will soon replace, you know, all of that. We will have our personalized feeds. So, you know, I definitely see social media has that ability still, but overall, it's, you know, it's something for us to be worried about.
How much of a responsibility do you think artists have to, you know, give voice to things like we're seeing in Iran, or things like we're seeing, you know, in the world politically right now, the ICE people over in the States, for example? That's obviously, you know, the current topic of the moment. There's a lot of chaos and carnage going on over there, and it looks like, you know, America is suffering massively and becoming, you know, obviously attacked by this one force of people. And, you know, there's, you know, we've alluded to the fact that politics is in a pickle, but it's like, it's massive. And, you know, I think that is the only way to fight back. And if it wasn't for something like Instagram, which, yes, of course, is toxic in some capacities, but how would we see all of that, you know, action on the ground that's happening, unless it was for somebody filming and sticking it on the gram. I don't know. I guess it depends who you follow to a degree, but personally, I really want to see that. I want to, you know, see this real-time body cam footage and understand what's happening. And we're never going to get that from the official channels.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's swings and roundabouts. Yes, it's it is great to be able to see the news firsthand and be able to access that. I think the consequence of it, though, is this fragmented, I think Benji talks about it, this fragmented front page. We're no longer in agreement about basics, you know, about fundamentals. We don't have a common understanding anymore. So yes, you know, I'm totally in favor of this channel for people to get these opinions out, but I think it's really important for us to have a shared front page, a consensus about what matters, and a degree of agreement over fundamentals. And in many ways, legacy media used to do that for us. But now it's so kind of bought and paid for, and it's so pandering and to the dog whistles, and you know, it's kind of lost its place. You know, I think it's social media on the one hand, but legacy media and the owners of legacy media on the other.
Obviously, we saw Bob Trafford, one of the lead speakers from last year, you know, diving into this subject quite, you know, brilliantly and not holding back and being very heartfelt and very authentic, I think, in terms of the work that he's doing and how much he's willing to risk and how deep he's willing to go. And for me, that was one of the most powerful talks when I was hosting on stage last year. And I feel, you know, he was on this radio show as well, sort of talking about it. And I think, like, how, you know, how much more difficult do you think maybe from last year it has become to this year, only 1 year later, to be able to find the truth within the media?
He was my favorite talk as well. I think it was a fantastic talk. And if anyone, you know, wants to review it, it's online and available, and you'll find it through the TEDx website. But yeah, I think it's increasingly difficult. I think, you know, with the election of Trump, there's been such a sea change in so many areas where things that used to get funded and supported, you know, all sorts of courses, all sorts of aid organizations are all having their funding taken away. They're increasingly being targeted, and it's becoming much, much more difficult to operate. You know, I really believe that fascism is cyclical and that we are seeing that, you know, rise again. This kind of wave of populism is fascism returning. And the one thing that fascism does is try to shut down these dissenting voices and to choke off the, you know, the oxygen they need to function and the funding they need to carry on.
I think that's why it's so important, you know, for people like Bob to be able to take to the TEDx stage, because, you know, I had just no idea that organizations like that existed. And as a journalist as well, I was just like, yeah, absolutely blown away to hear that those kinds of people, and the way that he actually met, you know, the guy that runs the organization, when I heard about it over dinner, was, you know, obviously you have the opportunity to meet the speakers at the after show party. Tickets available for that as well on the TEDx website. But I think it's, you know, that opportunity to sit down with these kinds of people around a dinner table in Ibiza, you know, is nothing new. But it is in terms of the way that this whole event has kind of grown and put a spotlight, I think, on, you know, the kinds of conversations that I think this island is incredibly hungry for.
That's why we do this. You know, we are, you know, a largely volunteer run organization. There is no profit made from it. It all goes back into, you know, doing it next year. And we do it to give people like Bob a platform. You know, that's why we put all the work in. And I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's really great for the island to have this, you know, cultural moment in the middle of winter. But also to bring in these outside voices and to give platforms to, you know, platform for people on the island to share their ideas as well.
How does it feel to be part of that sort of TEDx community, as you said, in the middle of a dark midwinter? It's been a pretty interesting winter thus far on Ibiza. It's obviously January, and we're moving into February now on this. It's going out on February the 9th. Obviously, we're in the middle of dark, deep midwinter here on February the 9th, at the start of... sorry, Antonio. Thank you so much for being so patient. Obviously, we're in the deepest dark depths of midwinter, but I think, you know, it is a warming and a heartwarming event that, you know, is created and brings the island community together, which is something I think this island specializes in anyway, in terms of the intrinsic, you know, close interlinkedness of the people here and the community that gather. But I think there's something very special about, you know, the TEDx community that is built and is woven together by these kinds of conversations. And it gives people, you know, they can go there. It's a bit like a podcast, you know, they can listen and it gives them something to sort of dine out on and stories to share and new ideas. Well, new ideas worth sharing, right? That's the tagline.
Yeah, I mean, I love being a part of it. I think it's a fantastic group of people, really varied skill sets, and it's really an amazing thing to see it come together. You know, my part is just one small part of it, which is just curating, finding the speakers. But then this whole machine goes into action, from production, from marketing, from sponsorship, you know, amplification, the print, the catering, everything. There are so many sides to it. And really, it's much more than just the 9 talks that will go out on the day. It's a whole experience that you'll go through. And, you know, if you come to the after party as well, you know, it's a great thing to be a part of.
How long have you been living on the island?
10 years. 10 years next month.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
10 years is a massive marker, actually, of surviving on this island. I think, you know, obviously it's an incredibly creative community here, and I'm assuming that's the number one reason that you decided to move here.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a whole lot of reasons why we move here, and I think, you know, one of the first talk on the day is actually about the Rondais, the folk tales of Ibiza. And we, you know, we really love that talk because I think it reminds everyone we're drawn to this island. And yes, there are beautiful beaches, there are amazing clubs, there's fantastic weather, but it's something to do with the culture of this island, the culture of the people here. And it really wasn't that long ago that it really was a completely different place. And so few of us really know or understand that culture. And I think that's why it was right for us to kick off with that subject on the day, on March the 14th. And I think we could all do with just learning a little bit more about the culture, because it's much more than we think of the reason why we're here.
Let's leave it on this, but what's the number one thing that you think you've learnt, I guess, through being part of the team about, you know, culture in Ibiza that you can, you know, or maybe over the last 10 years of being here?
I think it's that we're hungry for it. You know, I think the people on the island are really hungry for cultural experiences, ideas, and something that really shakes us up and gets us thinking in a new way. You know, we're really familiar with what's available here on the island and what the kind of, you know, popular stuff is. But I think what's really nice is curating and cultivating something to stimulate people and get them thinking.
So out of the last, 3 years of events that we've created, what's been the number one idea that you think you've taken away that you feel is worth sharing?
I think that, you know, this will be our fourth TED. And I think what they've all come to show is that dialogue really matters. You know, is that we definitely have differences, but I think dialogue, exchange, understanding of each other, sharing ideas, this is what actually brings connection and brings us together. And I think this is what TED is all about, is sharing those ideas, having this communal experience, and then talking about it together afterwards.
Exactly. Dining out on good stories, it's always a winner. That's the number one reason that I love having these conversations. So thank you so much for coming here on The Reset Rebel. This is episode 215. Can you actually even believe it? We started this podcast in 2018. And if you do enjoy listening to it, I'm giving a little podcasting course next month online. You will find the link in the episode show notes. I'd love to share that with you. And I've loved sharing Adam with you as well. Adam Norris, lead curator of TEDx Ibiza. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Reset Rebel.
Thank you, Joe.
Reset Rebel. It's The Reset Rebel.